This programme is brought to you by the monthly partners of Reasons to Believe. For more information, please visit our website at reasons.org/monthly partner.
Welcome to Imago Dei, Engaging Minds Created in the Image of God. This is Avra's Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, Ken continues with part two of two on Christianity and science. Are they enemies or allies? Ken, on the first one, we went through the first five of the 10 points that you wanted to make. I think there are 10 of the 10 that you had in your book, Without a Doubt.
Yeah.
And we're going to continue 6 through 10 of those 10 points that you wanted to draw out, and we were fascinated by those, and we're going to continue now.
Yeah, I want to again touch on some of these scientific assumptions. I've mentioned before in other podcasts that I was on a radio debate in Fresno, and one of the professors from the university up there said in his portion of discussion in the dialogue debate, he said, "I have no beliefs."
Wow.
And
why was he there?
I said, "Well, you know, I said, could I push back on you a little bit there?" I said, "You do believe that there's a real universe out there." And I said, "Don't you also believe that in good measure you can understand that universe?" And I said, "Isn't it also true that you view math and logic as being reliable tools to unpackage all of this, and that you can trust your mind and your senses, and you even believe, a la, Albert Einstein, you believe that there's some kind of coherence, amazing coherence between the universe itself and the human mind?" So I said, "Don't you have a lot of beliefs?" Because, you know, Lawrence Krauss would tell you that science doesn't have any beliefs. You know, it's all about facts. It's all about reason. But there are a lot of assumptions that go into explaining how the world is there and why it's there. And so in many ways, when you're talking about scientific explanation, you also have to kind of go back and say, but how do we explain all of these assumptions? How do we explain the preconditions for scientific understanding? And those questions are addressed philosophically. They're addressed historically. Here's Alistair McGrath, who is not only a scientist, but a historian of intellectual ideas. Alistair McGrath, the British Protestant theologian, he has said that theology informed the practice of science. He said, first of all, Christian theology provided the conceptual framework for science to thrive. That here is that framework that we can understand science. He said, secondly, Christian theology can serve to augment the explanatory power of science. You know, that's something, Dave, we don't often talk about, and that is, what about the things that science can't explain? I mean,
just give them time. They'll figure it out.
Give them time. Where is the meaning in all of these kinds of things? How does the universe derive meaning and purpose and significance? Or what about the moral sphere?
Of course, there are
of life
atheistic scientists, naturalists, who will throw a fish in the direction of religion, in the sense that religion provides us with some way of coming up with values, morality.
Yeah, yeah, evolutionary.
That, yeah, this kind of thing.
It does seem to me, Joe, that, when I look at some of the writings of skeptical authors, atheists, agnostics, that there is a recognition that you have to make sense of reason and morality. That is, if atheism is going to win the day, if a naturalistic atheistic worldview is going to become a powerfully accepted point of view. And to some extent, I think it is. I mean, you know, look at the Western world, look at the academy. There is a good bit of skepticism. You know, the Pew Report says that maybe 14% of the world's population may be non-religious, secular. And so even though that's a small percentage compared to, what, 86% that are religious, those are often people of prominence, you know, in especially at the academy.
The brights, the smart.
The brights, the smart people. But the idea here, again, is that if I'm going to make a naturalistic, atheistic worldview to be accepted, then I need to bring into that some understanding of how I can account for reason, how I can account for morality, and how I can give the world meaning. And may I say that is they got their work cut out for them to explain how reason comes from non-reason, how human morality comes from a non-moral source, and how purposeless beings can somehow carve out meaning in the world. Now, if I adopt theism, it's not difficult to think that if there's a mind behind the universe, that he might create temporal creatures, finite creatures who have mindfulness. And it's not difficult to explain that if God is a moral source, then his creatures would have a moral connectedness. As Paul says in Romans 1, they have a conscience. Mm. And they know that they're accountable before the Lord. And so often life is trying to dodge your accountability before God. And if God is infinite and eternal, and if he spoke the universe into existence, if time and space and matter and energy, to speak scientifically, if God created all of that, then it's easy to see how he would invest in that meaning and purpose, hope.
You know, Ken, I'm sorry, Dave. Yeah. As you continue on with the points 6 through 10, it just occurs to me that as you engage this scientist from Fresno State, was he a biologist, or do you know what kind of scientist he was?
You know, it was an interesting title he had. He was a professor of evolution.
Okay, yeah. It just occurs to me, and Dave, I'd be interested in your comment, that I wonder if he would get away with that kind of comment years ago. That is, as you stated here, as a scientist, I have no beliefs. Well, my comment is, well, you have at least one belief, but you say, you went on to
Joe,
say...
Joe, you're a trained logician there.
You went on to say he had many beliefs. That is, today we push people towards careers in the scientists and, quote, practical fields that, yeah. I wonder if years ago he wouldn't be able to get away with this, because people would be on to him. You know, students or anybody. It's like, come on, you're going to get away with it? And he didn't, because you were there. But I wonder if he's telling students this all the time, you know? And it's just, go ahead, Dave.
Well, I think an explanation, at least, perhaps, is that he is one who has taken the viewpoint of, say, I think Richard Dawkins talks about this, of what they call blind faith. So he used the word, I don't have any beliefs. Probably what he meant was that I don't have any faith.
Yeah.
As defined by Dawkins as blind faith, or faith that doesn't support or isn't supported by any evidence. Because that's the way Dawkins thinks. And many of these atheists, that faith is where you don't have any evidence. You believe in the face of evidence in something. And we would call, as theologians, we would call that blind faith. And they say, we believe in things for which we have evidence to support it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But of course, as a Christian, I don't have blind faith either. I reject that definition of faith.
Yeah.
I have faith that is supported by evidence. I am supported by reason. So it's a false dichotomy here.
Yeah.
And you, of course, nailed him on the fact that he, in fact, did have beliefs. Now, he would probably argue, perhaps, that he has evidence to support those beliefs, but we're not so sure.
And I think, Dave and Joe, that, you know, most philosophers would say that knowledge is what we call justified true belief.
Right.
That is, you have beliefs. And see, that's where he wants to stay away from the idea that all I have is beliefs. I don't have any beliefs at all. Well, actually, knowledge involves belief.
That's right.
It's justified true belief. I have beliefs. They are true, and I have some justification. I have some way of grounding them, evidencing them, if you will. Yeah, that's right. There's nothing wrong with beliefs. And faith, the Greek word in the New Testament, the New Testament biblical word, the verb to believe is pistuo. Pistis is the noun, to have faith. And I think a fair definition of it is confident trust in a reliable source. So I'm putting my confidence, and that's the very foundation of faith. I have confidence in God. But the idea of a biblical faith is there's a reliable source.
Mm-hmm.
I can trust God. I can trust Jesus Christ. And so biblical faith is a belief, but it also involves knowledge.
Has warrant.
It has warrant. That's exactly right. That's the term. It's a warranted true belief. Now, I want to give you another quotation here. I was watching a series on television some time ago about the Apollo astronauts, and one of the things that came out of these programs was that when the astronauts began landing on the moon, they saw this desolate wasteland, you know, the moon with all of these craters, and it's lifeless, and it's like being in, you know, out in the desert where there's just, you know, seemingly no life at all, but there really is no life at all. And then they turn around and they see this globe, Earth.
Hey, beautiful.
This beautiful globe that's just, you know, has all of these multicolors, and it's just teeming with life. And some of the Apollo astronauts were religious, and they said, you know, I kind of had to come to the moon to appreciate Earth. That, wow, here I am. I've spent my whole life to get here to the moon. And I get here, and it's dead and it's lifeless. Then I look over my shoulder and I see that remarkable place I call home, Earth. And, you know, some of the Apollo astronauts recognize that, wow, what a remarkable thing. In fact, here's a quotation from Wernher von Braun. I always have a sense of pride in thinking about Wernher von Braun, Dave. Wernher von Braun, of course, was a German who was making rockets for Hitler. I don't think he was ever a Nazi, although these days there are lots of concern about whether all of the Nazis had been held appropriately accountable. But Wernher von Braun was captured by the United States Army. It was the 44th Infantry Division, which my father was a part of, that captured Wernher von Braun. And I'm told the German rocket scientists wanted desperately to be captured by the Americans and not the Soviets. So he's, of course, brought to the United States and, you know, is the leader of NASA. It takes us to the moon. Here is a quotation by Wernher von Braun. He says, I find it as difficult to understand a scientist who does not acknowledge the presence of a superior rationality behind the existence of the universe, as it is to comprehend a theologian who would deny the advances of science. You know, I think that's a nice way of putting it. I think theologians at times need to take off their hat and say, wow, the scientific enterprise is an amazing enterprise. But I also think the reverse is true, that scientists need to look and say, How did all of this come to be? Why is it here? And, the, you know, these kind of why questions, I think, are appropriate to ask. And many of the people that were behind NASA recognized that, wow, there is something seemingly going on behind the scenes of the universe in which we live. And that there are questions that need to be asked. Now, let me bring you back, if I can, to something we touched upon a couple times in the previous program. This is Richard Pertill, kind of giving us some insight about C.S. Lewis's argument from reason. The argument from reason is essentially, how do we account for reason and rationality? If there is a mindless universe, where does mind and reason and rationality come from? Here's what Richard Pertill, a Catholic philosopher, one who appreciates Lewis. Dave, I must say, I think it's interesting how Lewis is admired by people from various theological mm-hmm. traditions. I find that I find Calvinists who like him. I find Wesleyans who like him, Catholics, Protestants, you know, Orthodox. Interesting man. Here's what Pertill says. He says, one way of getting a preliminary insight into Lewis's argument from reason is to ask whether it is a product of mind or mind is a product of nature. If God created nature, as Christians believe, then nature is understandable by reason because it's a product of reason. Not surprised. If there's a mind behind the universe, we're not surprised that reason, math, and logic can be used as tools to unpackage the universe's intelligibility, because creation is the product of that rational mind. On the other hand, if mind is produced by nature itself, then it's a lot more difficult. The atheists, again, I think, have a lot to kind of unpackage in terms of some of those issues. Okay. In our last program, we were looking at 10 principles that I enumerate in my book, Without a Doubt, and we're up to number six. And this one says that because the world is not divine, and therefore not an object of worship, it can be the object of rational study. Now, you know, if you're a Hindu, or if you're into Eastern mystical religion, and the universe is kind of God and you're God, then, you know, you may not want to take out your scientific tools and clap them on to a living being, a God. But the early scientists who held theistic and Christian beliefs, they didn't believe the universe was God. They believed the universe was the product of God's creative power. And so much of Eastern religion, science is difficult, Dave, because you're kind of blending the divinity and the natural world together. But in a Judeo-Christian context, there isn't that concern. I'm studying what is the product of God's creative power, and I can therefore take off my gloves, if you will, and get down to the details of a real analysis. Yeah. Here is Rodney Stark. Professor Stark teaches at Baylor University, the Baptist school in Texas. He says this, Christianity depicted God as a rational, responsive, dependable, and omnipotent being, and the universe as his personal creation, thus having a rational, lawful, stable structure awaiting human comprehension. That's, you know, that really, I think, does say that it's not a surprise why the religions of Judaism and Christianity would have such a head start when it comes to the scientific enterprise.
And is he looking at a long period here when he says Christianity depicted? Is he What period is he looking at here?
Well, he is he's talking about kind of historic Christian theism. Okay. As it develops through the centuries.
Okay, all right, yeah.
That God is the rational behind the mind behind it, and therefore it is again intelligible. Mm-hmm. That science is a good thing. It's something that people can practice. Now, let me touch just a little bit about this idea of the life of the mind. I think it's good to think in terms of we can use our mind in the way that we love God. And Christians have generally thought that God's giftings in terms of our cognitive abilities, our rational faculties, that we can use these things in our love for God. And that using them in studying nature is an appropriate use. And so again, this idea of the universe being detectable, it being comprehensible, is the byproduct of Christian theology. Okay, let's move to number 7. Human beings possess the ability to discover the universe's intelligibility. Again, this is not a surprise if Christian theology is right, if theism, if a biblical worldview is right, this is not a surprise. Human beings are made in the image of God. Now, I don't know exactly what that means totally. I think it probably means a lot of things. I think it means in some way, I think we resemble God, that we're thinkers, that we have the ability of being reflective, and we have rational faculties, moral faculties, spiritual faculties. It means other things, as we have talked about the program. Undoubtedly, it means we're relational creatures. We're made by the Trinity, so we can relate to one another. Maybe it means taking dominion, right? We have other elements, but the idea here is that because we are made in the image of God, and because God has networked the world together, we're able to unpackage these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And so Christian theology is a very powerful supporting element to the development of science. And that's why I think it's unfortunate that sometimes Christians kind of give the impression that science is ungodly, or atheists will give the impression that religious people can never really respect science, when in reality it is Christian theology that says if God made the world, if he made everybody in his image, if he networked the world together, then we can expect that God would we can expect that human beings would be able to carry out the capacity to do science.
He would allow us to have that insight. I want to clarify something earlier. I think the last time we were discussing these points, point 4 was that the physical universe is intelligible. That just means that it has order. It has for someone who has intelligence, it's intelligible.
Yeah.
But that doesn't deal with this question that we're addressing right now, is are human beings intelligible?
That's right.
Animals, for instance, have brains, but they don't have this kind of intelligibility. Mm. They're not able to contemplate the universe and discuss whether the universe began or has always been here. That's just not part of their intellectual capabilities.
Yeah.
But God has endowed us, we believe, through making us unique in having the image of God, being made or created in the image of God, that we have that kind of intelligibility that allows us to discover the intelligibility that is built into the universe.
That's right. Human beings are really a rather a profound and mysterious entity. Why why do human beings have capacities that kind of dwarf the animal kingdom? I mean, undoubtedly, you know, the birds fly south and, you know, animals make
tools
or they, you know, they make some kind of shelter or something like that. But then, you know, human beings put telescopes up outside the atmosphere so they can study nature and, you know, put spacecraft on the moon. I mean, humans seem to have this ability that moves beyond. And as you say, Dave, not only are we able to kind of understand the information content of this universe out there, but we ask these why questions. We ask the deeper questions. And so it's not just that the universe is somehow intelligible. Then there's the question of why should we ever expect humans to have the facility to track that intelligibility?
And that's where science assumes that we have it.
That's right.
But don't explain it. Mm.
Now, if we said nothing else in these two programs, if we said nothing else, what we could say is that all of these things that we have been talking about, these assumptions that go into science, they fit well with a biblical worldview. Mm. That's not saying that God did it, but just looking at the assumptions that go into science, it fits well with religion. It fits well with theism. It fits even better with a biblical perspective. And I think we've also illustrated there are times where other worldviews don't fit well. Sometimes Platonism is not a good fit. Sometimes Eastern mysticism is not a good fit. Sometimes atheistic naturalism is a tough fit. We're not sure how they're able to explain some of these kinds of elements. So in terms of explanatory power, so number 7, human beings possess the ability to discover the universe's intelligibility. Number 8, God created human beings with the ability to hunt and gather data and to recognize the importance of testing truth claims. I find it interesting that John Calvin, the great reformer, it's awfully important to recognize that Luther and Calvin, the two most important Protestant reformers, really they were medieval men. I mean, Luther's born in 1483. Luther's born in 1509. They're born as the Middle Ages are starting to wind down. And Calvin and Luther look forward and you see the Reformation, the Renaissance. You see in the 16th century, the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century with Luther and Calvin. But it's the 17th century in which you have the age of revolution of science.
The Enlightenment.
This Enlightened period that moves forward. Calvin says that because human beings are made in God's image, they can hunt and gather the truth. They can hunt and gather the truth. I want to touch on that a little bit. I wrote a blog article some time ago, and I was thinking at the time, what kinds of things draw people's attention to our faith? And I mentioned a couple things. I think, for example, a very robust work ethic gets people's attention. I think when somebody works hard, somebody's going to come along and say, why do you do that? Why don't you just go along to get along? Where's the fire in the belly come from, right? I also talked about treating people respectfully. I mean, you know, the guy cuts me off on the 91 freeway, not very friendly toward him. But at some point, I come to the realization he's fallen, but he's still made in the image of God. So I need to be careful about what I say about him when I'm angered by his poor motor vehicle skills. And so the idea here is, as a Christian, I uh, I want to treat people respectfully, even though I don't always like them, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes I don't like them. Well, the middle one, I kind of talked about three ideas that might get somebody's attention about your faith. So if you work hard, if you respect people. But the middle one was this. Do you prize and are you careful in how you handle the truth? I mean, from a biblical point of view, God is truth with a capital T. Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. I think Christians should be, I think we should prize truth. And that can be not only capital T, but lowercase t. I think we ought to be careful about the way we handle truth. I think we should do all we can to give people the indication that we're reliable, we're trustworthy, we're a good source of knowledge and information and truth. But here Calvin says, because we're made in the image of God, we can hunt and gather truth. Just like early human beings would hunt and gather food, we're able to hunt and gather the truth.
This is an interesting idea that the idea that God didn't just make truth readily apparent. He says we have to search for it.
Yeah.
Like the Proverbs say, you have to search for it like you would for silver and for gold.
Yeah.
It's not just laying around on the ground. You have to dig for it.
Yeah.
That there is a, that he has to be built in a process that.
So it's like a mining venture. You have to prepare for it.
Work at it.
You have to work at it. You know, that's true. And of course, again, I think this journey that we're on, that God has us on this journey, and this journey involves the development of our character, the development of our personhood. And, you know, sometimes it's a difficult journey. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you work hard and don't find much silver and gold. Mm-hmm. You know, and other times you hit the Eureka moment,
right,
where you discover all of these good things. But that's right. You have to have good tools. Mm-hmm. And if you want to know the truth, you have to have a careful mind, a diligent mind, a deliberate mind.
Sometimes we think that heaven is going to be a place where everything is going to be handed to us. You know, we don't have to work anymore.
Yeah.
But I suspect that maybe that's not true, that we'll have to work there too, but we'll have the character to do it right. We'll have the work ethic that we won't fritter our time away, but we'll work at it efficiently and effectively and honestly.
I had an atheist on Twitter. He was very surprised when I said, I think that there'll be many libraries in heaven.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, you guys don't want to know anything, right? You're just up there, jumping up
sitting
and down, sitting on a cloud doing nothing. Yeah. I mean, part of that journey and part of being made in the image of God allows us to move on that parallel. Well, let's move on to number nine. Number nine, God encourages, even propels science through his imperative to humans to take dominion over nature. Now, Dave, what do you think of the jobs that God gave Adam in the garden? I mean, What do you think about this naming of the animals and the caretaking of the garden and God commissioning Adam to take dominion over this? I mean, how do you think of some of those things in terms of kind of, you know, the broader scope of our relationship to nature, if you will? As a scientist, I'm asking.
Well, it seems like he was sort of entailed with scientific job, in a sense of God didn't want him just to name, oh, you're Dick and you're Harry and you're Sam.
You're Lucky and you're Louie.
Right.
Yeah, it does seem that
he was meant to study these animals and see what some of the characteristics were and then give them a name. A name in Hebrew is often meant to entail some character quality or something about that person.
So there's working going on.
And he's working in the garden. He's a gardener.
Yeah.
God planted the garden, but he had a helper here. He had
a caretaker.
Come in here and work the garden and discover. So there's a lot of discovery entailed in this process that he went through. A lot of maybe excitement over what he discovered.
Yeah.
He could discuss what he discovered with God when he walked with him in the cool of the evening.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of this, the things that he was coming to be aware of. Again, as we think about this, the idea in these last couple points is that God prepared human beings to be seekers, to allow people to discover truth and knowledge and information, and that the natural world in which we live and we're a part of. Dave, are you comfortable saying human beings are part of nature?
Well, yeah. I mean, we have a lot of characteristics in common with the natural, with animals, for instance. We look the same of some of them.
Some more than others. So, yeah,
right. We have a lot of the characteristics, but there is a distinction. We're not like the naturalist who says we're basically the same kind.
Yeah.
But we're actually of a different kind.
Yeah.
There's a quality or a characteristic that we have that's above the animals.
Yeah, this kind of philosophical of degree and kind.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Well, if we're part of the natural world, if we are made in that context, then science seems like an appropriate vocation. And let's tackle number 10 here, the intellectual virtues essential to carrying out the scientific enterprise are part of God's moral law. Joe, I don't think that's something we kind of reflect enough on. I mean, to do good scientists have to be honest. They have to be fair-minded. They have to be deeply committed to discovering the truth.
And reporting the truth.
I mean, that's a whole other area. I mean, I guess as a Christian, I would be comfortable saying that there's a sacredness to doing the scientific process, to, you know, relaying to people that this is what we have discovered. That there is an integrity and a deep commitment to discovering it and communicating it. I mean, those moral principles, again, are part of a Judeo-Christian worldview that we want to prize truth. We want to handle it carefully. We want to help people discover things. I say this in my logic class from time to time. I say when I first started studying logic, my temptation was to be a smart aleck, you know. Because I developed a skill, I could put my finger on the mistake that another person mm-hmm. made in their reasoning, and you know, and so I wanted to show off.
You had some clever Latin sounding
that's right
term that you
yeah,
could use.
Yeah, I could quote these Latin terms, and but of course I tried that with my wife and it didn't go over very well. But what I tell my students is, say, look, I'm here to help you as an instructor, but I'm here to show you that helping people to discover the truth through logic is the task of a humble person. Helping, teaching, mm-hmm. guiding, and directing to do good science takes good morals, right? It takes the foundation of these kinds of elements. Well, Christian theology takes these things seriously. Let me quote the Belgic Confession. This is a Reformed Confession of 1561, Article 2 is entitled The Means by Which We Know God. And it talks about the book of nature and the book of scripture, two books, that there are two books. The first book is a metaphorical book. It's a figurative book. It doesn't have pages. It doesn't have a spine, but it's a repository of knowledge. It's nature. Here's what the Belgic Confession says. We know him, God, by two means. First, by the creation, preservation, and government of the universe. Since the universe is before our eyes like a beautiful book in which all creatures, great and small, are as letters to make us ponder the invisible things of God, his eternal power and his divinity, as the Apostle Paul says in Romans 1:20. I discovered that this idea of the two books, this figurative book, goes very far back into Christian history. Augustine mentions the two books idea in his writings, and it's probably earlier than that. Well, the Belgic Confession then mentions the second book. Second, he makes himself known to us more openly by his holy and divine word, as much as we need in this life for his glory and for the salvation of his own. This idea of two books, that the book of nature and the book of scripture relate to each other, they cohere to each other, and as Christians think about some of these things, we talk about, in fact, C.S. Lewis talked about two things about science you want to avoid. You don't want to deify science. I sometimes think that Lawrence Krauss and maybe Stephen Hawking have deified science in a way. I don't want to overstate that. On the other hand, just like you can deify science, you can defy science. And I think sometimes Christians are potentially guilty of that, where we don't take into account that the book of nature says a great deal. Now, at RTB, we take these two books seriously, and we say they should be read side by side, that there's an integration that's possible. We talk about general and special revelation. So this again, this idea of the figurative book of nature, the literal book of scripture, the two books. So, Joe, one more time before I close, I want to bring us back to two things. I want to look at those scientific assumptions one more time. That there's an objectively real cosmos. That there is an intelligibility of that cosmos, and that there are tools, things like the validity of math and logic, that human beings have reliable cognitive faculties and sensory organs to utilize to track that intelligibility, and that there's congruence between the human mind and the physical reality. All of this makes really good sense in a Christian, in a biblical theistic model. And that's why a lot of the early Christians were either Jews or Christians. Why the early scientists were Jews or Christians. Mm. Their worldview fits with all of this. Those beliefs are compatible. And I think that, I think at minimum, these are the kinds of things that we can say in a time where there is so much secularism, where there is so much insistence that there's conflict between religion and science, that the Christian worldview does a great job of providing a foundation for those pre-commitments to science, those scientific assumptions, if you will. And you know, that's not saying that that Christianity is true, but it is saying that Christianity seems to have solid explanatory power and scope. Let me draw your attention. We began the previous program with a quote from Paul Davies. I thought it might be appropriate to quote him again. This is a more popular article that he wrote. It's from the New York Times, November 24th, 2007. It's entitled Taking Science on Faith. Taking Science on Faith. Paul Davies, again, is a physicist and cosmologist. I like him. I like him because he's a really good scientist. I also like him because I think he's pretty fair-minded. You know, mm-hmm. I think he would relate to me as a religious person in a fair-minded way.
He himself at least claims not to be a theist.
That's right. I guess maybe he would be a skeptic, or he certainly holds his cards close to his vest, if you will. He also takes a lot of criticism from the atheist community, because sometimes he seems to say positive things about mm-hmm. a religious worldview. Well, I don't want to make him any more enemies by saying how thoughtful I think he is. But Paul Davies says this. He says, over the years, I have often asked my physicist colleagues why the laws of physics are what they are. The answers vary from that's not a scientific question to nobody knows. The favorite reply is there is no reason they are what they are. They just are. Davies then says this, and I love this quote. He says, the idea that the laws exist reasonlessly. I love that word, reasonlessly. The idea that the laws exist reasonlessly is deeply anti-rational. After all, the very essence of a scientific explanation of some phenomenon is that the world is ordered logically, and that there are reasons things are as they are. If one traces these reasons all the way back to the bedrock of reality, the laws of physics, only to find that reason then deserts us, it makes a mockery of science.
Mm-hmm. Powerful quote.
You know, that's a great quotation, mm-hmm. because it does say, and I've often said this, Dave, I've said it to you, and I've said it to my other science colleagues on the RTB Scholar team. I said I've always found it kind of ironic that being around you guys, I know that the scientific community, you know, they recruit the brightest minds. They give the best training to these young minds. They spare no expense in kind of exposing them to the best environmental conditions. And so the brightest and the best, the highest scholastic research, you know, the critical areas of degree, and then they turn around and say, but all of this came from a non-rational, non-mental, non-mindful source. This is a reasonless universe. Mm-hmm. You know, the science is so intellectually prepared to then draw the conclusion it's a reasonless universe. I just find that ironic.
It's ironic.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question that comes up when you listen to Dawkins talk, Richard Dawkins, the atheist. He objects to the notion that religious people, theists, invent God as their explanation for things. And he takes the viewpoint that to invent God is a much more complicated explanation than is necessary or is appropriate. You know, he'll in the past, where this is part of this God of the gaps kind of idea,
yeah.
that he's taking issue with, but he'll frequently characterize the God solution as far more complicated than what is necessary. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I wrote an article broadly in that area, and Dave, typically the way I think about it is, look, I think an effect needs an adequate explanation. I think if we're going to say that, you know, we have this tremendous complexity of a universe where we have minds, we have vibrant and complex life, that we need an adequate explanation for this. And it's not that, well, I can't find a naturalistic explanation, so I'll just point to God. I would say it is more of an abductive approach. It is weighing and balancing and asking, well, what is the best explanation of how minds could be involved, about how humans could have the qualities and characteristics? So I don't think it is a God of the gaps. I don't think it's this kind of reactionary view. Mm-hmm. I think rather it is along the lines that scientists engage when they consider a possible hypothesis. They're asking what could be the best explanation for this kind of phenomenon. And from that standpoint, I mean, what is more reasonable, that mindfulness, that mind and consciousness came from something that lacked that fundamental reality, or that there seems to be a source behind mm-hmm. it? So that would be kind of the way that mm-hmm. that I approach what that kind approach, of thing.
Yeah.
More of an abductive best explanation type of approach.
The thing is that you have to have an explanation that is more, you got to have a cause that's greater than the effect.
I think so.
So you have to have an explanation that is bigger, or quote, in his terminology, more complicated
yeah.
than what the effects are that we see.
Yeah.
It's kind of analogous to Newton came along with his laws of motion, and that worked really well for science, but we ran up against the boundary where we couldn't explain certain things. So then someone had to come along and invent Einstein's theory of relativity. Well, it's more complicated. Why do we have to deal with this complicated relativity stuff? Why isn't Newton's stuff good enough?
Yeah.
I mean, hey, it works most of the time. Why do we have to invent? Well, the reason that we have to have relativity is because Newton's laws is not sufficient. It's not a big enough explanation to be the cause of the effects that we see.
Yeah.
So we then have to broaden, we have to enlarge our cause, as it were, to include relativity. Well, I mean, now the question comes, well, how big does that cause have to be?
Yeah.
Well, these guys will invent the multiverse to explain the fine-tuning in of our present universe. That's a pretty big cause.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big unknown.
Yeah.
The more they have to explain, the more they're willing to acknowledge what they have to explain, the bigger that cause has to be.
Yeah.
And we're moving slowly towards God.
Yeah, it's that term agency you used some time back.
Yes, that, agent.
That, you know, that it is an inference that we're drawing, and maybe it is more complex. Of course, it's also true in Christian theology that we believe that God is basically a simple being. Now, that means a little something different
than a philosophical
what
principle.
Most people mean. But it does mean that, yeah, you need an adequate explanation.
An adequate explanation.
Yeah. All right, Joe, those are our two programs kind of exploring the question of Christianity's relationship to science. Is it one of enemies or allies? I think historically and philosophically, most of the time it's been one of allies. Mm-hmm. It's not that there aren't conflicts, and there are conflicts today, but the Western world has been influenced by a science that had its roots deeply tucked into a theological worldview.
Yeah, great stuff. You know, I'll end with a little story here. You probably are aware of this. I was on Facebook a while back, and somebody asked, I think it was a student, somebody asked Bill Nye, the science guy, mm-hmm. Whether he or she, I don't know the gender of the student, whether the person should study philosophy when they went on to college. And Nye kind of gave a half-baked answer, and using philosophy, of course, as part of the answer. And he was taken to task on Facebook by a bunch of Christian philosophers. So you can't help but use philosophy, right?
Yeah. So yeah,
that's the answer. And
we're stuck with you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So it's part of the fall.
Yeah. But this has been very enlightening. I really appreciate these two podcasts and sure hope our listeners are enjoying and benefiting from Imago Dei. So thank you, Ken, for that. And be sure to check out Ken's blog, reflectionsbyken.wordpress.com. Ken's latest book, of course, God Among Sages, as we have mentioned before, get two copies of it.
Yes.
Not one, but two copies, because you're going to want to pass one along to a friend. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening and join us for the next edition of Imago Dei.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.